This message comes from the preaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
I was sent an email a few weeks ago, and I guess this is proof I'm getting old, because I enjoy this kind of thing now. It's for grandparents, and those of you younger, just endure it. I think you'll actually enjoy it. But the title kind of caught my attention: How Grandchildren Perceive Their Grandparents. Several stories attached, like this one. Grandmother writes, "My young grandson called the other day to wish me happy birthday. He asked me how old I was, and I told him I'm 62. My grandson was quiet for a moment and then asked, 'Did you start at one?'" Isn't that great? It's a long way away from one. One grandmother sent in this story. She writes, "After putting my grandchildren to bed, I changed into some old jeans and an old shirt and proceeded to wash my hair in the sink. As I heard the grandchildren getting more and more rambunctious, I finally lost my patience, threw a towel around my head, stormed into their room, and chased them back into bed with some rather stern warnings. As I left the room, I heard the three-year-old ask her siblings with a trembling voice, 'Who was that?'" Well, a grandson was visiting with his grandfather one afternoon, and he seemed to be just kind of quietly studying his grandpa, and then he blurted out, "Grandpa, do you know how you and God are alike?" Grandfather wrote, "I kind of polished my halo a little bit and then responded, 'Well, no. How are God and me alike?' He said, 'You are both really old.'" You're right, that wasn't funny at all. Here's one more, my favorite. 4-year-old was asked where his grandmother lived. He thought a minute and said, "Well, she lives at the airport. When we want her, we go get her. When we're done with her, we take her back." You never know what kids are thinking, right? Even those wonderful little grandchildren. When I read those, I kind of set it aside because it brought a question to my mind that I thought I might pose eventually, and it is the question for today. I wondered, how does the world perceive us? How do they think when they think of us? And I wonder how close we are to what they really think about us. Now, as I tried to answer the question in my own mind, obviously for some, the church, you know, really doesn't exist at all. It might be a building located on the corner of Tryon and Holly Springs, but that's about it. For others, the church does exist, but it's for weddings and funerals and maybe Easter or Christmas services. For many, the church exists, but they're not really sure why. They're a bit confused. For still others, the church exists, but it really shouldn't, because it just gets in the way and kind of makes us feel bad. I recently read the results of a 2-year commission in England. The kind of results that people like me read, you'll never want to read it, but I'll just summarize it for you. But it was a commission in the religious world on the condition of religion in Great Britain. And what first arrested my attention to this commission report was the headline. It said this, quote, "Britain is no longer a Christian country and should stop acting as if it is." Well, the reason that intrigued me is because it described the members of that commission as high-ranking judges, political leaders, some well-known clergymen, even the former Archbishop of Canterbury, all weighed in and were unanimous in recommending that we need to really get over our Anglican, past and not be so dogmatic and be more inclusive, they said, of other faiths. In fact, one of the things that they submitted was an opinion that the coronation ceremony be completely overhauled to be more inclusive. If we live to see that day, the Prince of Wales will be coronated, and according to the tradition of that ceremony, and they've done it for centuries, at some point prior to his coronation and receiving the crown, he would say, among other things, that he promises to uphold the laws of God and the true profession of the gospel. And that commission said, we really need to get past that. We need to shed that dogma. In other words, the church exists, but we're not sure what in the world we're supposed to believe or communicate, and maybe we got it wrong and shouldn't be so dogmatic. By the way, I will share this with you, which was encouraging to me. Buried in that report was sort of an aside note that while the Anglican Church is diminishing in its significance, there is this explosive rise of the Evangelical Church in Great Britain. And I know of several brothers who are serving in the pastorate in those countries, and I was so thrilled to read that acknowledgement. Back to the question. How does the world, let's be more specific, how does your world perceive the church? Has it ever occurred to you that the average person's perception of the church is directly related to their perception of you and me? For every one of us who claim the designation Christian, our world perceives the church to be nothing more or less than a collection of people like, well, us. So they view the church as however they view you and me. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity for us to be living. And I think we're living at the perfect time in church history and world history to rewrite and redefine the perception people have of Christianity and of the church and of God. Belonging to a local church really is actually being willing to shoulder the responsibility to repair in your world, to reconstruct the reputation of the church. And with that, repairing and reconstructing the reputation of Christianity. And with that, and above and beyond all of that, ultimately to repair and reconstruct, to rewrite the perception our world has of God. There's never been a better time in this country at this time to make sure that our Christianity is not staying indoors, that it isn't staying behind those proverbial stained glass windows, which for us is block walls and basketball goals, but you get the point. It doesn't stay in here. It's to go out there. And what a wonderful time for us to do just that. How do we do that, by the way? How do we take our Christianity out into the public arena? Well, as members of a local church, individually and corporately, if we understand that the church is perceived collectively by virtue of how we're perceived individually, we need to make some promises to one another, ultimately to the Lord, that affect the community. Now, we've been talking about these promises. We divided them into three sections, and we're going to begin today and end with that last batch. We talked about promises related to conduct, primarily personal, individual promises, promises related to the church, and now promises related to the community. And the first one is rather simple and short. It's going to rewrite, by the way, the public perception of God and the gospel, but it's fairly simple, and here it is. We're making a commitment to pursue a good reputation in every aspect of life. Now, when I say that immediately, I hope to convey the idea that to rewrite the perception of our community related to God or the church or Christianity is not the launching of a program. It's really the launching of people. It isn't some special method that's just going to be amazing. Where we're launching individual people into the community who pursue a good reputation. And that isn't the pursuit, by the way, of a reputation so that you can brown nose your boss or get a promotion or win the blue ribbon or get a pat on the back or whatever. This is a personal commitment to integrity out there in the community. Let me show you where Paul addresses this idea. Turn in your New Testament to 1 Timothy in chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3 is a chapter which we have addressed in previous studies, delivering the qualifications for men who will serve as elders. The list also is a wonderful guideline for practical Christian living, sanctification, that is, how to grow in Christ and what that looks like for every man, for every woman, for every young person. So it really serves as a wonderful guideline. Paul writes specifically of elders and more broadly to those who want to grow in Christ. And he says this, look down at verse 7, buried in the list of qualifications. He says this, and he must have a good reputation with those outside the church. That's a phrase that refers to unbelievers. Must have a good reputation. And he's not talking about inside the church, but outside the church. And the word he uses for good refers to a reputation that is, you could use the synonyms, virtuous, profitable. In my Greek study, even the word delightful showed up. Honorable would be a good synonym. In other words, a good reputation isn't just something we get by showing up here or serving one another in here in some profitable manner or being gracious or delightful or smiling at people around here, going the extra mile for people in here. Paul effectively says that a good reputation is not only developed and to be exercised and pursued in here, but out there. So we are honorable out there. We are virtuous out there. We are delightful out there. We're profitable out there. Simply put, you're for real. You're real. And people can pick up on the genuine article of goodness, whether it's in the office or the classroom or in the shop, in the boardroom, or in the neighborhood. In his book entitled Being Holy, I've had this article pulled aside for some time now, Jay Kessler tells something that happened in the life of Phil Donahue that marked him. Now, if you're too young to recognize the name Phil Donahue, you'll be just fine. Donahue had a reputation of going after the church. Whenever I'd watch his show, which wasn't often, but every so often when I was in college, he would have some pastor, and I just kind of held my breath, hoping that man would survive. Donnie was very bright, very skeptical, and he loved to point out the inconsistencies of organized religion. In fact, one of his pet peeves he would write in his autobiography, which Jay Kessler is going to quote from. He said one of his pet peeves was the fact that religious leaders would do almost anything for media attention. In his autobiography, which Kessler quotes from, Donahue tells about an encounter he had as a young man. He was a news reporter in Ohio, and he was sent on assignment to West Virginia to cover a mining tragedy, an accident. And he writes that he went by himself. He had his little mini cam with him. This would have been probably 40 or 50 years ago. When he arrived, it was so cold, Donahue wrote, his camera didn't work. And so he put it in his coat to try to warm it up so that it would work. And he noticed while he waited that families were gathering there at the site. And there were women and older men and a lot of children. Many of the men trapped in the mine were fathers. And then Donahue says, the pastor from a local church arrived. Donahue observed and wrote that this man was rather rough-hewn, poorly dressed, and didn't speak eloquently. But he genuinely cared and gathered the families around in a circle, and they held hands, and he prayed for them in clear, passionate terms. All the while this was going on, Donahue says he's trying to get his camera to work, because he realizes he's missing a very poignant moment. And when you know it, as soon as the prayer is over and people are dispersing, his camera comes on. So he went over to the pastor and he asked if the pastor would regather the folks and and if they'd hold hands in a circle, and if he would pray again, so that Donahue could film it for the evening news, and he told the pastor that it would more than likely be nationwide. And at this point in his autobiography, Kessler says, Donahue paused long enough to add that over his long career, he'd been with the world's best known preachers, evangelists, church leaders, and they all to a man were willing to redo a scene for the camera. But not this man. He writes that this simple West Virginia preacher responded with words he would never forget. This rugged, unpolished man said to Donahue, young man, I didn't pray for the news. I'm sorry, but we've already prayed, and I will not pose. I will not pose. A kind of Christian who redefines and reconstructs the genuine article of Christianity is a Christian who isn't posing. They are who they are, whether the cameras are rolling or not, and you know who they are in your world. As they pursue that kind of virtuous and profitable and delightful reputation, they're the ones that'll stay after and do an assignment no one wants. They're going to prepare behind the scenes. They're going to work with a difficult student, or they're going to work with coworkers on a project that really isn't their responsibility. They're going to toil over an assignment in order to get it right. And the interesting thing about a good reputation that God has in mind for us all is that it's crafted really when the cameras aren't rolling and nobody's standing there ready to applaud. And that's why it becomes so remarkable. You just did it. You just chose that. And it's in those scenes where the Christian earns this label good, honorable, virtuous, delightful, profitable. And Christianity and the church at that moment, whether anybody really recognizes it in the world or not, their perception of God is changed ever so slightly. Now, when Paul makes this statement that those who are growing, certainly those who serve as elders, have a good reputation, that implies there is the opposite, right? If he says there's something as a good reputation, that must mean there's something as a bad reputation. He's making a distinction between something we need to pursue, and it's good, and by implication, something we need to reject, which is bad. Now, let me show you a detailed description of that contrast. Turn to his letter to the Ephesians. Turn back a few pages or so to the book of Ephesians. In chapter 4, Ephesians 4, verse 17, this I say therefore and affirm together with the Lord that you walk no longer as the Gentiles walk. That word walk, you might expand in your mind for simply walk around. That's what it means. You're walking around. It's a reference to your lifestyle. It's a reference to your desire, your passion. It's a categorical description for someone's life. This is the life and the pursuit and the passion and the goal of the Gentile, which is a categorical term for someone who does not believe the gospel. This is their life. And by the way, we're only going to touch down, but before we even do that, John Stott from Great Britain, who pastored for many decades faithfully, now with the Lord, his commentary on this paragraph said that this provides a good description of the downward spiral of an unbeliever's heart and life. Notice verse 17 again, the latter part. Just as the Gentiles also walk in the futility of their mind, being darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the hardness of their heart, and they, having become callous, have given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness. In other words, they just can't get enough. Here's the digression. Their hearts are hardened, he writes. The original word refers to a stone harder than marble. We use the expression today, they have a heart of stone. From their hardened hearts come darkened hearts. From darkened hearts come calloused hearts. Your translation might read at verse 19, having lost all sensitivity. Mine reads, having become calloused. The idea here is that the unbeliever's heart is moved beyond the point where he used to kind of have a pang of guilt when he did that. He used to kind of feel bad about that. And then that digressed until ultimately he is actually proud of the fact that he does it. That's the idea here. And that leads him to reckless living, or as Stott wrote, a reckless heart. And he writes in verse 19, Paul does, describing them as greedily, that is hungrily, practicing every kind of sensuality. And the word Paul uses there is a word that simply describes somebody who's literally throwing off all restraint and flaunting itself in the act of sin. In other words, sin is something they are now very proud of. So that's the digression. Ultimately, then, that describes a bad reputation. Don't walk around, don't pursue, don't have this lifestyle as a believer like the Gentiles or those who do not believe. And now what Paul will do is contrast their reputation or lifestyle with the believer. Look at verse 20, Ephesians 4. But you did not learn Christ in this way, if indeed you've heard him and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, the old man, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit, and that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind and put on the new man, that is the new self, which is in the likeness of God. It's been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. This is very critical to understand. The construction of this command indicates a repeated putting off and a repeated putting on. He's not writing to people who want to become a Christian. So you make a decision. You're going to put off the old man. You're going to put on the new man. He's talking to believers who are growing in Christ. That is that sanctification. And you repeatedly put off the old man. You say no. And you repeatedly put on the new man. And this is our battle, isn't it? He's referring to those who will pursue this kind of good reputation. You're going to have this kind of battle. And he puts it in an analogy of taking off old clothing and putting on new clothing. Maybe you did that after Christmas. You got that new sweater or blouse or a pair of jeans or whatever, and you put it on. Maybe you discarded that which was old, or maybe you've still hung it in the closet and you might wear it one day. That's the analogy he's using here. He isn't talking about salvation. He's talking about sanctification, which is another way of referring to our lifestyle. You say no repeatedly to the old way, and you say yes repeatedly, daily, to the new way. In fact, Ken Hughes wrote in his wonderful commentary on this paragraph that part of our challenge is that those old garments are so comfortable. I don't know about you, but I've got an old shirt, and I wear it when I study in the winter. Friday from about in the morning when I start writing till Saturday night when I'm finished, if you show up, which I don't recommend you do, but if you do, I'm going to be wearing this old shirt. It's very comfortable. It has a little fleece, a little wool. It has my shape even when I hang it in the closet. It don't wash it. I don't want my wife ironing it. It's so comfortable. And it's interesting that Ken Hughes says that you can be scarcely aware that you are wearing that old shirt, that old life, because it naturally drapes over you. He says, unless the Spirit of God or another believer holds up the mirror of the Word, and you look and you go, oh my, I've put that old thing on again. That's the daily contest of the believer. And the battle can shift moment by moment. One day it's a battle against bitterness. The next it's a battle against lust. Sometimes it's hour after hour. It's a battle against resentment. Or maybe it's a battle against covetousness. Or maybe it's a battle against laziness. Or maybe it's a battle against pride. And in one day, maybe battling every one of them and more. See, to the unbeliever, it doesn't matter. There's no battle. There's no battle. If I do something wrong, I'm proud of it. There's no battle. To the world, to the unbeliever, the world is a playground. To the believer, the world is a battleground. And a good and godly reputation, beloved, never happens without a fight. A good reputation never happens by accident. You are constantly battling Satan, the flesh, the devil and the world. So, the Old Testament wise man, I think, comes to mind, and that text is added, not because we're going to go there, but just for your reference. But he provides an incredible testimony of someone who pursued a good reputation. He was honest. He was honest. He wasn't on the take. Everybody else around him was. That's why the king put him over all the other men, because they were on the take, and he didn't want more loss to come to the kingdom, and he puts Daniel over them. He's a humble man. He's a pure man. He's a single man for his entire life, living in the midst of a decadent, sensuous, immoral world, Babylon. And eventually his political opponents decide to bring him down. How do they bring him down? The same way they're still doing it to this day to bring their rivals down. They check into their past, they read their emails, their texts, their taxes, whatever is public domain, and they're looking for dirt. Right? So that's what they do to Daniel. They inspect everything. And I love that text in Daniel chapter 6 and verse 4, where these political opponents regather and they come up with a stunning admission that Daniel was faithful. There is no evidence of corruption in him. In other words, this guy is clean. He's clean. Is it any surprise that Daniel would dramatically redefine and reconstruct for the community in Babylon what it meant to be a follower of the true and living God? Is it any surprise that two of the kings under whom he served would one day individually come to make that recognition of the singular glory of Yahweh? Daniel rewrote their perception of God. Here's the application. Someone with a godly reputation rewrites and reconstructs the reputation of God and His church. Now that leads me to another promise as we individual Christians and as a local assembly corporately make in regards to our community. Here's another way to go public. Here it is. To bless the community through personal labor, talent. To bless the community through personal labor, talent, investment, and skill, reflecting and glorifying the diligence, creativity, and excellence of God's character. A little longer, but in the Old and New Testaments, you have a number of references that we could spend a long time just covering this principle of bringing blessing and progress and advancement to the secular kingdom as a reflection of the excellence of our Creator God. This again is the testimony of Daniel in Babylon. Why would Daniel care about Babylon? Why would he care that the king not get taken to the cleaners? Couldn't help but think of Joseph as another illustration, which is why I've left these texts here, these latter chapters. If you work through this Bible reading calendar, I think you're going to get there in January. You're going to read the biography of this individual in Egypt, sold into slavery, eventually becomes prime minister, and he effectively saves that kingdom and the surrounding world. And you have to ask the question, why care? Why not let Egypt become a dust bowl? Why not let Babylon burn? Instead, Jeremiah the prophet challenges the Jewish exiles as they leave for their Babylonian captivity. Jeremiah 29, he says, on behalf of God, seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf. Earlier in this farewell message, Jeremiah says, here's what God says to all the exiles. Build houses. Live in them. Plant gardens. Eat their produce. Multiply there and do not decrease. It's a long way of saying live there in such a way that you bless them by your presence. In fact, we could say it this way. Live there in such a way that if you disappeared, they would miss you. They wouldn't be better off in that office without you. If the church disappeared, would our community be better off or at a loss? That's the question. And the very fact that we care, the very fact that we pray, the very fact that we invest and build, and maybe even plant a garden, or like me, try to grow some grass. The very fact that we try to do those things is a reflection of the excellencies of God, and we demonstrate by means of those activities the character of God to the people around us who don't know who God is. And we represent Him. And He would call this good. And in living that way, we actually invite others to join us. And again, we're demonstrating the character of God. Before God takes us home, we know this isn't home. He's taking us home. And in living in such a way like this, we invite other people to join us as we await God taking us home. Let me show you one more passage quickly. If you'll turn to the right again and head back past Timothy to Titus. Titus chapter 3. If you were with us a couple of years ago in our studies through this letter, you may remember that this island of Crete where Titus is ministering, establishing churches, he's appointing elders. This population are largely the descendants of pirates. It was a tough community. In fact, they were so devious, so given to lying, that there come this expression that to be a liar was to be a Cretan. That's how wicked they were. Well, how do you influence a community like that? Okay, what's going to be your strategy for reaching this kind of world? What are you going to do? All right, what is Titus going to tell them, and what is Paul, by means of the Holy Spirit, going to tell them? Look at verse 8, Titus chapter 3, verse 8. This is a trustworthy statement, and concerning these things, I want you to speak confidently, so that those who have believed God, now he's talking to Christians, those who have believed God will be careful to engage in good deeds. He's not talking to people who want to become a Christian, and you become a Christian by doing good deeds. He's saying for those of you who believe, you're believers, be careful to engage in good deeds. The only time the words be careful show up in the New Testament, if I were God, I'd have said that 100,000 times. Be careful. Only this time. Be careful. It means to think thoroughly. It means to be intentional. Be intentional in engaging in good deeds. That's what he's saying. Again, Paul isn't telling people how to get to heaven. He's telling believers how to live because you represent heaven. Here's your strategy to reach all these descendants of pirates. Here's the plan. Be intentional to do good deeds. Have you ever thought about the fact that good deeds are the advertising campaign of Christianity? So start there. By the way, I find it interesting, and I didn't know this until late into my study, that Paul uses the same word here to describe good deeds as he used earlier in Timothy to describe a good reputation. Same word. Good, virtuous, honorable. Deeds. So as we pursue a good reputation, we demonstrate a changed life through doing good, honorable, virtuous, delightful, profitable deeds. All of which imply integrity and creativity and diligence and perseverance and excellence. Good deeds, beloved, point to a good creator who laid it out for us in his own excellence and creativity. Remember in Genesis chapter 1, he goes on this amazing creative demonstration, right? Brings everything into existence. And periodically he would stop and say, that is good. That's good. And every time we, with our hands, with our mouths, our minds, our effort, our creativity, our initiative to something good. It reflects our relationship to a creator who does good things. By the way, it's not surprising either to me that a demonstration of good and virtuous and profitable and delightful things out there in the community, wherever you work or live, will lead some, Jesus said, to observe your good deeds and glorify your Father who is in heaven. You'd think that you're going to win your community by a doctrinal course on heaven, by a doctrinal course on deity, God. No, start with good deeds and build a bridge to good doctrine, which introduces them to a good God. Listen, the world takes note of those who work and serve with excellence and integrity. They know who the good guy is at the office. They know who the good girl is on campus. You don't have to write a name tag. You know, say, I'm the good guy. Wear a white hat. You don't have to do that. They know. You don't have to pin it to your blouse. I'm one of the good girls. Mm-mm. They know. People at school know who you are. People on that hall, on that floor, in that shop know who you are. In every facet of life, the world knows the people whose lives are in pursuit, not perfectly, but in pursuit of good, virtuous, honorable, delightful, honest, profitable deeds. Because that's the reputation you're building. And with every deed and every response and every conversation and every decision, no, I'm not going to wear that anymore. I want to wear this. No, not today. I'm going to walk this way. Every time you have this incredible opportunity to rewrite your world's perception of God. What a great day in which to do that than this day. I close with this anecdote from Watchman Nee. I have his writings, but I've only read The Normal Christian Life, read it in college, and it marked me. He was an evangelist a generation or so ago in China. And he had a friend he writes about who lived in a small village in China. And they lived at the base of a small mountain. And at the top of the mountain, a plateau had been developed and built over time for this one particular friend of Watchman Nee's rice paddies. And then, as you can just imagine, down that hillside were these terraced rice fields. Watchman Nee's friend was a believer, a rice farmer. He had the opportunity to share the gospel with his neighbors. They had a little evangelical church in that village. But there was one particular neighbor who was never interested in what he had to say, was very skeptical, if not unkind. Every day of growing season, this farmer had to work harder than all the other farmers because he had to pump water by hand all the way up to the top of that little mountain to fill his rice paddies with water. It was slow, laborious, painstaking work. But every day he would pump water into his rice paddies and fill his field. One particular season, every morning when he returned up the hill, he would find that his neighbor, the one disinterested in the gospel, had opened the dikes surrounding the Christian's field so that the water from his field flowed down to the mountain, down the mountainside to his field, which was just underneath. And it would fill his field with water. For several weeks, the Christian farmer ignored the injustice. Try to put yourself in his sandals. All that work deceitfully taken away every night while you slept. I would imagine posting guards. He didn't say anything. But after some days, he became desperate because he was now working twice to fill the fields with water. So he took the matter to his little village church and asked the believers to pray with him about what to do in response to this neighbor's activity. After several days of praying about it, he and some other men arrived at what his response ought to be. So the next morning, the Christian farmer, Watchman Nee writes, rose early that morning and first filled his neighbor's fields with water. Then he pumped water up the hill into his own fields. He did this for several days without saying a word and never intended to his neighbor. Watchman Nee tells how that neighbor eventually broke down and confessed and was overcome by the genuine demonstration of humility and undeserved blessing and became a fellow member of that church as a believer. Your story may not end the same way. That neighbor may not confess anything. That co-worker may not break down. One thing's for certain, they do not deserve your blessing any more than we deserve the blessing of God. I couldn't help but think in my study, Egypt didn't deserve Joseph. Babylon did not deserve Daniel. Perhaps your world doesn't deserve your testimony either, and perhaps doesn't appreciate it, but every act, as you pursue a good reputation, as you pursue the demonstration of good deeds that bring a blessing to the community and to your world, they ultimately allow you and me to do something great. Rewrite. Reconstruct. Repair. The perception our world has of God. Could there be anything better to do than that?
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared but not changed or altered. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.